talk about urban sprawl, and I've called earlier for your thoughts on that, so feel free to let me know. Do you think we're too sprawly as a nation, particularly urban areas? 0418 226 576. Are we too ready to grow out our cities rather than be a bit smarter about the way we do it and make them perhaps a bit more compact? This is in the context of news today with environmental groups slamming the Victorian government's move to push out Melbourne's boundaries with 6 new suburbs on the city's northern and western outskirts. This is expected to create 37,000 new housing lots, which will eventually provide homes for more than 100,000 people. While housing industry groups say that's much needed to meet the needs of a growing population, others warn that it comes at a price, the loss of parklands and the loss of farms as well. Here, for example, is Rosemary West, an activist from the Green Wedges Coalition, speaking earlier in the day on ABC Local Radio in Melbourne. Ah, we've lost it. Sorry about that. Anyway, you might guess that she was very, very critical. It's not just Victoria, though. New South Wales government is also encouraging new housing developments. It's been redirecting first home owner grants to those building new properties rather than buying established homes. So is this the best way to accommodate Australia's growing population, expanding the boundaries of our major cities with new suburbs on the fringe, or should we increase the density of cities within their existing boundaries? Our panel tonight to discuss this is Julie Katz, the National President of the Urban Development Institute of Australia, and Dr. Wendy Steele, Research Fellow with the Urban Research Program at Griffith University. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We do now have that grab that I was going to throw to before, so that might set a tone for the conversation that we're about to have. So here, for example, is some of the criticism of what the Victorian government's announced today. Rosemary West, an activist from the Green Wedges Coalition.
We know that most people want the green wedges protected. We know people care about farmland, about the environmentally significant wetlands and grasslands and woodlands that are still in the green wedges, but that have been encroached on, of course. And someone at some point has to say no more. We have to think about this and ask people what they think, because every survey that's ever been held on green wedges comes out with vast majorities wanting them protected. The problem is most people can't afford developers' prices because they're building new houses on this land. You know, you don't have the old houses on large blocks that my generation had when we were looking for first homes. What you've got is very expensive new houses and units. Really, it's the pointy end of the population debate. And I think we need to link these developments to the population debate. Not that I think it's driven by population either. I think there's a very simple reason why we're seeing these developments, and that is that developers have got way too much power over policy in our state, and probably the whole nation, but certainly our state.
There you go, Julie.
Wow.
National President of the Urban Development Institute of Australia.
Oh, gee, yeah. She must be in a different place than I am. I'd say that developers certainly have an interest in growth of any major city. Basically, if a city doesn't grow economically, it can actually diminish itself and it can actually start to lose population. And nobody actually that I know wants that to happen, because population growth means economic growth for the country, for the GDP, and generally for future generations.
Well, there are people who don't want this to happen. I mean, there are plenty of people who would stand up and say population growth itself is a problem.
Well, just population growth, it's a big debate, I suppose, as to whether economically does a country need population growth to remain viable, to remain economically strong in its own right.
And in fact, I'm getting my feeling lot of is, anti-population yes. growth text messages as we speak.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah. I think it's quite a good debate, and I'm willing to have that one.
Okay. But let's assume population is going to grow, whether or not that's a good or a bad thing. Let's assume it will, because I think that's a fairly safe assumption, given the way that our political terrain looks at the moment. Is the best way to deal with it, and Victoria's done an example of it here, just by creating new suburbs on the fringes? Is that lazy?
Look, I think we're picking one day in one time span that we're looking at here, rather than sort of what's happened over time. Melbourne and most of the major cities have all had policies in place to try and consolidate growth within the established areas, to try and make better use of the sewers, waters, water supply, schools, universities, where the actual facilities now are. So it's been a regular activity of all governments around the country to say if we can increase use of those facilities and if we can make them more efficient in terms of putting some of the population back into those areas. Because just remember that household size has reduced significantly over the last 50 years. We've now got fewer people in larger houses. So people are further away quite often than the facilities that they actually want to be near. And one of the factors that really affects this is journey to work. You know, how far you have to drive or take public transport to get to work. And that's one of the things that consolidating or trying to increase density around employment areas, around shopping centres, around schools and so forth really works well, because you have less people on the road.
Well, it sounds like a very good argument for population density. I mean, access to services. It's one of the great ironies, I think, of the population debate, that actually the people who are in the most heavily populated areas of the country usually aren't the ones complaining, because they have great services.
Yeah, I think I was talking to a few people earlier today. Expectations are quite a bit higher these days too about what people, when they buy a block of land, put a new house on it, they expect that they're going to have the school round the corner, the kindergarten's going to be close by, and they're expecting public transport to be available within 6 months of them moving in. Unless you've got a certain level of density around those sorts of facilities, they're just not going to occur in a hurry.
Wendy Steele, are we too sprawly?
Look, I think at one level the debate is often framed around sort of residents' choice of big houses on the fringe or small sort of inner city apartments. And I think for many people they feel that a lot of the debate is under the radar, because so much of the oxygen around the debates are sucked up in whether or not we want to see the Manhattanisation of Australian cities, that people, when they hear about the kind of developments on the fringe occurring at great pace, certainly we've written about this kind of notion of colliding cities. When you look at a map of Australia, you see these sort of pinpoint dots of cities, but the actual fact is that we have mega metro regions which are sprawling across state boundaries, as we're seeing within the Gold Coast Tweed area, amongst others. And so I think that what we see is quite a complex issue, where there are lots of things happening simultaneously, but our our collective vision is sort of being oriented towards certain spots, and thus quite a lot is happening outside of the kind of realm of democratic debate, and thus when it comes to light, people are quite rightly feeling very upset about it, particularly in relation to issues of green space and ecosystems and such. But the debate is more than just around whether we need suburbs or whether we need more apartments. I think that's a simplistic debate. Really, the more interesting debate works on a couple of different levels. The first of these is coming to grips, in essence, with our urban nature in Australia. We've been in denial about that for really quite a long time. And what that's seen is a fundamental changing of our spatial settlement patterns to these kind of, look, it's an American term, megalopolis. It's an unloved and unlovely term. But there is some traction with this notion of mega metro regions. And the danger of that in Australia, or the complexity of that, is that there is no governance structure at present that adequately deals with these mega metro regions. We have a democratic deficit, as a number of us have argued, that doesn't quite take into account. And so in what's happening is that there's no one really keeping track of where these different developments are happening at the different scales. And whilst there are tentative steps to come up with a more strategic vision, these are still in their formative stage.
Isn't it because we don't really have a clear philosophical aim here? Well, it's not clear that we're looking for a higher density living, for example. So we might do a little bit of that, and then we do a bit of sprawl on the edges that are not properly serviced. Shouldn't we make a decision about this and then see it through?
Well, you're right, but that decision is not an easy one. Partly it's muddied by what we're seeing, say, for example, in New South Wales, with particular sort of silver bullet urban policy storylines, I'd call it, say, around housing. But what we're not seeing is how the kind of argument around the need for more new housing and thus the release of more land, how this plays out as part of a broader political agenda, if you like. And I think that some of the calls that we're seeing for, the streamline of planning, for... know, in New South Wales, for example, even the New South Wales Planning Department has argued that there are four key issues that complicate planning and the planners are overly pedantic, and these four areas are Aboriginal culture, issues of biodiversity, riparian corridors and bushfire planning, and the complexity of these issues is being accused of slowing down housing. I mean, I think we need to take a much more nuanced and complex understanding of what the issues are rather than this kind of silver bullet. We need more supply of housing. We therefore need to reduce planning barriers and open up more land. I think that's a simplistic approach that isn't fundamentally supporting a more sustainable city.
Julie,
context.
Can I get you to respond to that, but in your answer pick up the question about the loss of parks, mm-hmm. the loss of farms, the concerns about that?
Yeah, sure. I think this where you're going with this, Wendy, of we need more government, we need, you know, we're not in the decision-making process.
Yeah.
We all have a democratic society. We appoint, you know, we vote for who is in power, and we've got to, there are so many controls in place, consultation processes, legal processes, planning panels. There's so many exhibitions of things. There are so many areas which anybody who feels that they want to make a comment, either positive or negative, they have room to do that in so many ways. The politicians, to a large degree, respond to that one way or the other, which is their job. I mean, they're there to be the, you know, listen to the people's comments and then make some decisions. So we're already in some ways quite overly governed with state, local and federal government. As an Australian economy, we probably have more government than a vast majority of Europe or even the US.
But is there actually any thinking behind it?
I just think that just arguing that we should have more debate about it doesn't really, and we should be more in the decision making, doesn't really help. I really like what you've said earlier, that what we really need to do is decide where we want to be and how we want to get there, and then say, okay, in 10 years, in 30 years or whatever, we need to be here and this is where we want to be. What do you think? And every major city around Australia has plans in place, metropolitan strategic plans that have been worked through for consultation workshops with vast numbers of groups of people with all different nationalities, religions, you know, they have got the broadest range of people to give their views on what they think. So I just wonder about the idea that we've got a process that works well. It's been shown that we can economically keep Australia going very healthily. In terms of the comment about green wedges and what we should do with you know, growing a country, one of the difficulties is that as you go in to try and build growth into the and build more houses, if you like, or to try and make better use of those schools and the smaller household sizes that we've been dropping for the last 50 years or so, once you go into those, you become becomes quite an emotional issue, because people have their largest asset is usually their house. And if they are concerned that the house could be subject to reduction in prices or whatever, they become quite emotional about that. And you'll see a lot of people object when you put in applications for an apartment block, a supermarket or whatever, to try and provide better services to the community around it in terms of retail services, or can be a cinema or whatever, that people generally say one of their objections is it will reduce my property value. And that is really the culmination of all the thinking, not necessarily that they disagree with change, but their major asset could be reduced in its value.
It's not a very good basis for policy making, though, is it?
I think
no, and that's why planning doesn't regard reduction in property values as something that it considers in that light. There are much more significant things, and as you've pointed out, environmental aspects, and we call it the salt and pepper approach. You've really got to designate areas all around every major city, and this is happening, and it has happened, where you say, look, these areas are so important to agriculture, these areas are so important to habitat for a particular endangered species or for parkland or whatever, and those areas are completely specified in the metropolitan plans as no-go areas. And you need to separate those out really clearly and get the community to agree that those are worth putting a lot of energy into saving and retaining in that predicament and or in that land use, and then you have to go and say, okay, well, what do we want to do with the rest of the area?
It doesn't have to be agriculture. I mean, think of Central Park in the middle of Manhattan.
I think if I could pick up on a comment that was made there, I think, you know, in terms of the system working, I think that, you know, there are a lot of signifiers that would say that in many ways that's probably not quite accurate. But particularly let's take the example of urban growth boundaries, where the community has had, you know, some expectations that those growth boundaries, you know, say will be retained, and in fact they then get pushed out through various lobbying tactics, etc., and that gets pushed out further and further. And I think what's particularly interesting is when the justification for that comes through in a policy agenda that's typically branded quite emotively as being about housing affordability. So in terms of in the name of housing affordability, we are being called upon to see more land opened up so that new houses can be built, and notwithstanding the complexity and the amount of land and available opportunities and reimaginings that could be happening with the land that currently exists and has already been urbanised. But I think also that the kind of very dominant discourse that comes behind that call is almost singularly coming from, if you look at the paper in the last couple of days in response to, say, for example, the New South Wales budget, it's all coming from development-orientated organisations who are using terms like, you know, this is a fantastic initiative, it's fueling growth, it's turbocharging new development. I mean, these sort of kind of the linkage of economic dividends that are available through this release of land. I think what we're missing here is the bigger picture, and this is what I'm saying about, you know, that we don't have the sort of debate that's needed to look at the whole picture of what's being lost in this kind of this type of expansion. And this is not getting back into the suburbs versus compact city argument. This is just saying that in terms of our urban policy, we need a more considered way of moving forward.
Are you saying we need to de-economise the debate?
No, not at all. It's about bringing balance back, because at the moment growth is as the previous person who was on recorded before mentioned, it's very much linked to issues about population. It's linked to our understandings about growth. And we wrote a book about Southeast Queensland growth, and what we were trying to argue was that growth shouldn't just singularly be about a quest for economic growth. It could be, you know, growth has so many manifestations in terms of community growth, in terms of growth in our understanding about our relationship with our, natural environment. It can be a growth in terms of our humility and our ways of linking in with each other. I mean, these are really important, and they're lost completely in this kind of silver bullet, single issue, knee-jerk response to certain policies.
Julie, I'll get you to respond in just a second, but it's just interesting, I'm just reflecting on the text messages that are coming through, and there seems to be a very strong suspicion of this value of growth, this sort of idea that growth is something we really should be focusing on rather than services. For example, this anonymous text: hospitals, water supply, transport infrastructure increasingly inadequate, suburbanisation running amok in the face of exploding population driven by the government obsession with growth. Pamela Stevens, for example, says higher density is inevitable. For example, infrastructure is not supportive of vast developmental sprawl in Perth. The transport is woeful. The lovely rural areas are gone. Another text: we're stuck in the mindset that growth is good, time to put a limit on it. Now, maybe this is a coordinated campaign from texters, and that does happen.
Fantastic.
That does happen on radio programs.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in that.
Yeah, it's interesting, the emotional language that's used quite often. I'm often, people say to me, developers create urban sprawl. Now, sprawl, just by its nature of that word, automatically gives you the impression of house upon house just marching off through the fields. Now, the density that most major city governments are looking for now is significantly higher than it was in the last 20, 30 years, and in actual fact, lot sizes or medium lot sizes have reduced significantly, and the UDIA has done a lot of work on assessing those lot sizes and how they've reduced from 2001 to 2010. And each major city is quite different. For example, in Brisbane, the average lot size is around about 680 in 2001, and it's now down around 550 in 2010-11. So, and this is consistent throughout all the major cities, that what has happened is people are being much more efficient in their use of land, therefore we're getting higher density on the fringes, and in some cases the fringes are higher density than the suburbs that have been developed 20 years before.
Sorry, so those figures relate to...
medium lot size in the major cities.
But that doesn't say that it's getting smaller on the fringes, does it?
No, this is medium lot size of new housing on the fringes.
Of new housing on the fringes. So, not incorporating new residential buildings that are taking place in the city.
Right. No. Okay. So this is the size of lots on the outer areas. But all I was really trying to pick up is every organisation has its own language. Sprawl is something that is a word that's used very emotively to say new growth isn't automatically sprawl. Sprawl gives you an impression which isn't necessarily the way it is.
It's picking up, though, on the fact that I've always found curious, though, that take any Australian city, take the biggest Australian city, Sydney, huge, but by world standards, pretty tiny population. I mean, go to any of the big cities of the world, have two, three times the population, aren't anywhere near as big in areas.
Well, you look at European cities and Asian cities, and they insist on having higher density housing around the major activity areas. I mean, you think Paris is a very dense city, but in actual fact, it's only six or seven stories around the Champs-Élysées and whatever. Mm. It's the outer areas and sort of up near the La Défense and places like that, which you've got the much higher density.
Yep.
So you can actually create, you have to say, how important is it to create the character and keep the character of a city and retain it in a sense and put the higher density and the more housing away from those areas because that's what people really value.
This is why the conversation still, you know, is still evolving and is still developing at quite an immature phase, because cities are products of their historical trajectory, and Australian cities have a particular trajectory that's linked within a constitution that didn't even recognise cities in any real sense and left it really to the purview of the states, and then the sort of scattering of local governments that now, you know, comprise, you know, except for obviously Canberra, comprise those cities. And this is where I was coming at with the democratic deficit, in that I appreciate your concerns about an extra layer of government, but our cities have evolved, and they've evolved within a particular trajectory that is now being redefined, and quite frankly, that discussion is now kind of, people are sort of stuck in they're not sure which way to jump, and they're not sure what vision to take forward, and that will only come with really robust and considered and informed discussion and debate and thinking.
And it very much depends where they are in their lifestyle.
Well, that's true.
You know, if they've got children who are looking for a house and just can't afford anything and want to stay near their parents or grandparents or whatever, you know, they have to go a long way out because otherwise they can't find a house.
I do. Unfortunately, have to leave it there because I've got to get to the drawing room. There's people waiting, and if I don't get there, I don't know. All sorts of things will happen without me being there, and I won't be able to come. Look, thank you very much. The drawing room, you'll be pleased to know, is high density. It's not very big. there's obviously a conversation that's got a long way to run on that. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for taking us through your thoughts.
Thank you.
Julie Katz and Wendy Steele are my guests. Julie Katz, National President of the Urban Development Institute of Australia, and Dr. Wendy Steele, Research Fellow at the Urban Research Program at Griffith University.